Usually I switch, but we're just having so much fun on this. Let's just finish it.
Yeah.
Shall we?
Yeah.
I couldn't, too many of you guys were on the internet, and I couldn't get her. I don't know if the Giants have won or not, so I'll know shortly. We're discipline of clarity. Yeah, we're talking about clarity. Concept, crafting a rhetorical strategy. Rhetoric, and let's talk about what we've introduced a word here to you, rhetorical strategy. Rhetoric is the art and skill of using language effectively and persuasively to change a person's mind and behavior. I use these two terms, art and skill. In all creation, there's two aspects. There's art, there's skill. To be a great painter, great artist, you have to have skill, but it's more than just skill. If you have skill, you're an illustrator. You see, if you've got skill in art, you're a painter. It's one thing to be able to take a subject and reproduce it. That's the skill. There's the art. That's the intuitive, that's the feeling, that's the emotion, that's the intangibles. Art, that's my background. I have an art degree, and so I have a lot of favorite artists. And you know, when we go on vacations, we always try to go places where I want to see certain paintings and collections. And one of my favorite American painters, a man by the name of Edward Hopper, you don't know him probably, but you've possibly seen one of the most famous American paintings of all time. It's called Nighthawks. You've probably seen it before, don't know what it is. But it's not birds, actually. Yeah. It's three people in a diner late at night. Yeah. You've seen it before. Some of you have. Hopper was a great artist, but not a very skilled craftsman. I'd always seen his paintings in reproductions, and you can never really tell till you see them in person, but when we went to London in 2004, my wife and I, for our 25th wedding anniversary, they were doing a big Hopper display, so I got to see all of his works, including Nighthawks. And I was surprised in seeing, when you got up close and personal, he was a much better artist than he was a craftsman. He was not as skilled in the techniques as he was of communicating a feeling. When you look at an Edward Hopper painting, you feel things. I mean, it's emotional, it's a visceral experience. Technically, he wasn't that great. Then you have other people who are technically brilliant, and yet it's not great art. And then again, occasionally you get the combination, you know, the great artists of all time, where you get art, emotion, feeling, pathos, and great technique. The first time I saw Van Gogh's famous painting, The Starry Night, if you know any painting, you probably know that painting. The first time I saw it, of course, I'd seen reproductions of it all my life, but I saw it for the first time 2002. It's at MoMA, Museum of Modern Art in New York. I was mesmerized. As a matter of fact, I didn't move for 45 minutes just staring at it. So it was not only great, incredible technique, but the pathos of it, the emotion. And so rhetoric is the same thing. You know, you got both of those. There's a skill to rhetoric, but there's also an art to it. And in communication, there's a skill, but there's an art. You know, there's some things you can teach, but there's some things you got it or you don't have it. I mean, that's what it is with an artist. You can learn all the skills, but either you got it or you don't. And there's some people God gives a huge intuitive ability to communicate. Pastor Rice Brooks is probably the most intuitive, gifted communicator I've ever heard in my life. As far as no preparation, on the spot, and yet brilliant. I remember one time, I was 1983, and I was pastoring in Knoxville, Tennessee. This is Maranatha days. And we'd had some good success with him coming and doing outreaches. So our major outreach, this is back when outreaches were events. Do you remember those days? Yeah, so we'd spend, you know, we'd invest, and this was our big deal, a lot of money invested, and we'd bring rice in for a week or so. This is when we get most of our lost people would get saved. And so we brought him in, and we had a big venue, and we put a lot of money in it, and he's at my house, and I'm trying to get him to the meeting, but he's pretty relaxed about time, you know, if you've worked with him before. And I'm not very relaxed about time. And I've become tremendously flexible over the years. So you understand, 1983, I was a bit anal about time. And I'm a little nervous because we're running late, you know, and he doesn't seem to care. You know, he's just cool. He's fixing and doing. And I'm just tense. We pull up. We're already late. You know, we're 15, 20 minutes late. And just as we get out of the car, he looks at me, serious as can be, he said, "You got anything I can preach?" I thought he was joking. He said, "No, really, you got anything I can preach?" I said, "What?" I'm thinking about all the money we spend. I'm thinking about this investment. I said, "You gotta be kidding me." So we pull him in, we get down there, and you know, I get up front and, you know, I'm doing some preliminary things. And every once in a while, I look down the front row. He's got his Bible. He's just paging through. He's going from page to page. And I make a little write, a little scribble something or not. And I think, oh, my gosh. All my money's wasted. He preached one of the finest sermons I'd ever heard. More people got saved. I remember consciously, I could still see, I was, is that 31 years ago? Yeah, 83. I remember thinking, "Lord, this is just not fair." I couldn't preach that good if I prepared a month. It just, I mean, you got it or you don't, right? So there's just a gift. Now, with Rice, he worked and he added skill to that gift and got him to a seriously high level. And I think all of us, there's some combination, more gift, some of us less gift, we just got to work harder. You know what I mean? So I think the sad thing is I see sometimes people that have tremendous gift, but they sort of rest on it. Because they can do it, you know? They can just get up with a lot of prep, without much preparation, and they just, and it happens. I think, God, I cannot do that. If someone calls me on the spur of the moment to get up and say some things, that's my worst nightmare. Now, give me a week to prepare, I'll rock. So, some people got it. And some people who got it work on making it great. Some people just trust in, I can kind of do it. And so, they're usually way up here, way ahead of everybody, but you know what happens? They don't get much better. They get about the same, you know, a little bit, but others then, they're getting better and better and better. So whatever, and I call it a starter kit, you know, whatever starter kit God gave you, that initial gift, we can invest, we can make it better and better and better by adding skill to it. And if you got a huge starter kit to begin with, don't trust in that. Add skill to it, and you'll go way beyond where you would have gone. You develop a rhetorical strategy by arranging your material in the most effective way to accomplish your purpose, accomplish your objective. And I don't know if you go through this or not, but it's a process I go through. Now, the only way to do this is you got to know the final address. That's why I work so hard on talking about outcome-based objectives. If you don't know the final address, pretty much you can go this way, you can go that way, you can take a left turn here, you can go right there. It doesn't really matter. You'll eventually get there. Though the clearer your objective is, the better, the easier this is. You ask yourself the question, if this is where I'm trying to get to, what's the best way to arrange my material to help people get there? And then you just work backwards, you know? I know when I would go to the doctors or dentists growing up, they always had these magazines for kids, and they would have the mazes, right? Do you have those for you draw a maze? You know, someone's here and you got to get the carrot here or something. I figured out early on the best way is to get to start with the carrot, and then you work your way back. Just work so much easier that way. And that's how you do the sermon. You know, when you figure out this is where I want to end up, then you just work your way back. Okay, what's the easy? I got to do this and this and this. So I created a set of questions, and these are the questions that I use to help me think through this rhetorical strategy. What's my clear purpose for doing this sermon? And I know we give an outcome-based objective, but you got to work with that and make sure that's your outcome-based objective in a very specific way, not just kind of broadly general. This is exactly for my audience. Here's what I'm trying to accomplish, and write it out. What exactly am I trying to accomplish? I just beat that question into my brain. What problem or potential problem am I trying to solve or to avoid in people's life? What central idea do I want to focus on? What key concept do I want people to understand? What attitudes do I want to change or reinforce? What specific behaviors do I want to change or reinforce? How will I know if I succeed with this sermon? What's the win I'm after? What are the potential obstacles in people's mind I'll have to overcome? How can this sermon underline and not undermine our vision? Let's talk about the discipline of language. And I think this is the last one in this session. Discipline of language. Acts chapter 18. Now a certain Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, acquainted only with the baptism of John, and he began to speak out boldly in the synagogue. Now, Apollos' preaching was so vivid and eloquent that the people listening, it seemed as if they actually saw Jesus crucified before their very eyes. If you'll take a little time and examine the outcome of his preaching, especially if you go back into the original language and look at the words that are used, what Luke is communicating is when Apollos preached, it was so vivid that the people in his audience felt as if they were at the actual crucifixion and saw Christ crucified. Now, that's some good preaching. That's vivid. I'm thinking back, one of the best compliments I've ever had in preaching, and the good ones you remember, you know, over the years. This was late 84, early 85. I preached a sermon from Acts chapter 27, which is one of the more dramatic narratives in the New Testament. It's Paul's journey to Rome. It's the shipwreck story. More detail in that narrative than we're used to in Scripture. And I preached it. I was in, we had a Maranatha church in Metro Phoenix at that time. And I remember afterwards, someone was complimenting me because it's a shipwreck scene, right? And so, and they said, it was so vivid, I was pulling seaweed out of my hair while you were preaching. And I thought, that's good, man. I haven't gotten that very often, but, you know, those are rare moments when you really just nailed it. And people, it's so vivid, they feel like they got to get that seaweed out because they're in the wreck. That's what Apollos was doing. He was eloquent, and it was so eloquent, it vividly created this experience. People felt as if they could see Christ right there. They were experiencing the actual crucifixion. Now, we learn a few things about Apollos when we learn about where he's from. He's from Alexandria. Alexandria was the intellectual capital of the Roman Empire, certainly not the political capital, but the intellectual capital of the empire, home of the world's greatest library in the early world. And people from Alexandria had a reputation for being highly educated and trained in rhetoric, with an especially powerful vocabulary. So Luke defines him several different ways, and I love this definition. What a great description of a preacher. This is my aspiration in life. First of all, he was an eloquent man. He was mighty in the scriptures and fervent in spirit. Now, I think we got that fervent in spirit down. I think we're passionate people. We're fervent about the gospel. We're devoted to Christ. We're fervent. Mighty in the scriptures, I think we're getting better. But now, this other designation, he was an eloquent man. Not so sure about that one. Eloquence, here's a definition. The ability to use powerful, vivid, and elegant speech to produce conviction and persuasion. Wow, isn't that awesome? The ability to use powerful, vivid, and elegant speech to produce conviction and persuasion. One of the most important methods for increasing the clarity of our thought and speech is vocabulary development. And this is because, before we say that, a couple thoughts about this. Now, I have been actively, systematically, strategically improving my vocabulary for more than 30 years. And my own personal testimony is the practical result of increasing my vocabulary, learning new words constantly, learning how to use words better constantly. The result of it is there's nothing that has been more helpful in producing clarity of thought and making my communication effective. So there's a lot of things that I've learned, a lot of things that I've done over 35 years to get better as a communicator. Nothing has paid the dividends for time invested as much as vocabulary development. It's the single most important thing I've done to improve my ability to communicate. That's a passion to me to get others. Matter of fact, if you attend my School of Campus Ministry in the States, what we do, we learn three new words every day. And they're drilled on those words. They're tested on those words unmercifully. It's part of our final exam. I beat those words, and it ends up being, you know, we have a short class, so it ends up being 102 new words. But I beat those words into their head. And at least I got them 100 new words. But what I do is I build in them some kind of desire to increase over time. Because I'm telling you, if you'll accept this discipline of vocabulary improvement, it will change your ability to think with clarity, to communicate effectively, and to communicate vividly. So I'm an evangelist for vocabulary development. And I haven't brought it up much here in the Philippines because it's an awkward situation, because it's a bilingual situation. So does that mean improve your Tagalog vocabulary? Or English? Or both? Or what? I think if you want to, if you think that your ministry is going to have influence beyond the Philippines, then it would be absolutely essential to increase your English vocabulary. If you feel pretty comfortable that your life's mission is this geographic locality, then I would probably put more emphasis on Tagalog or whatever different dialects are necessary. But whatever, it's the discipline of doing it that changes your whole thought process. It's weightlifting for the brain. And I was listening to a podcast this morning, one of the Every Nation podcasts. Larry Stocksdale, I guess, spoke at our international couples conference they had in December or something, and he's talking about weightlifting and training and keeping your body. He said the most complicated machine to operate at the health club. He said, you know what it is? He said, it's the front door. Just going, man. Just getting myself there. That's the hardest machine to operate. I thought that was funny. Oh, weightlifting, you know, it's resistance training. Resistance. In resistance, you're pushing against a heavier object multiple times, and it's breaking down muscles so that new muscles grow stronger. And you know, when they get, I turned 58 yesterday, so when you hit 60, I believe, you start losing 2% of muscle every year, you know, if you don't do anything about it. So resistance training, I swim for resistance training, but I do sprinting, and so not just your normal leisurely swimming, but it's resistance training just in the water. And you know, it's painful. You just don't want to do it. It's just hard work, you know, this constant motion. But it keeps making you stronger and stronger and stronger. Vocabulary development to build your mind. Let's talk about some of the sub-points here, and then maybe we can have a few thoughts about it. Why? Words are what we use to understand the world. I want you to think about this. A lot of people are hesitant about vocabulary development because they think, why should I learn words that if I used them, nobody in my audience would understand them? Why should I learn those words? It's not going to help me connect with my audience. It may just alienate me to my audience. It's a great question, but the answer is very simple. Words are not just about how we communicate. Words are how we understand. The limitations of your comprehension are based on your vocabulary. You'll never be smarter than your vocabulary. In IQ tests, they've determined that the closest link to intelligence is vocabulary development. Vocabulary development indicates IQ more closely than any other indicator. Words are what we need to understand the world. So when you lack words, you shut down new insights. It's impossible to understand concepts. You don't have the words for it. You don't have the vocabulary. That's one of the reasons children's learning is stunted based on their vocabulary development. As children learn new words, words come with ideas and concepts.